Welcome to another episode of The Layman. Today, I'm heading down to San Diego to interview Sarah Mills, process and product engineer for Dark Horse Consulting. They're a boutique consulting firm that specializes in cell and gene therapy. I'm going to see if I can get her to 3D print me a liver for what I did to myself in college, and maybe slap a few stem cells on my buys and tries, because it's bathing suit season, baby. Sun's out, guns out. Sarah, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, absolutely.
First off, Dark Horse Consulting. If you're a scientist who works at a place called Dark Horse, I can't help but think you're trying to take down the X-Men or the Avengers or something.
Oh, well, that's my night job. My day job's a little bit different.
Hail Hydra.
Yeah, exactly.
What exactly is Dark Horse Consulting?
So Dark Horse Consulting is a boutique consulting firm that specializes in cell and gene therapy.
Okay, cool. Now, this is always the fun follow-up on The Layman. What does that mean? Like, I could literally just, the whole hour of this episode could just be me going, what does this mean? And then you're just eventually like, well, an article is a, and the, and I'm like, What is gene and, what? Say it again for me?
Gene and cell therapy.
Gene and cell therapy.
So they're kind of two pieces of a larger thing, which we could call regenerative medicine. And regenerative medicine looks at a way to replace function in humans for a disease or a lack of function, let's say for a liver, an organ, a pancreas, or restore function. So for something like sight.
Okay.
And it uses either cells as the therapeutic product, or a virus that would modify gene activity in humans.
Wow. This feels like some cusp of a new world type stuff we're talking about here. Because it is sort of a new field, right?
Yeah.
Because I feel like we're talking like stem cells. Is that part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably what I have the most expertise in.
Okay, yeah. So I guess that's a good question. So as a product and process engineer, what are you doing within the world of gene therapy? I can't even say gene and cell therapy.
There you go. Yeah. So I think my expertise is in what we would consider human embryonic stem cell derived cell therapies. Okay. So
I think I can parse that out.
Right.
But please do for me, just in case.
So absolutely. Yeah. Human embryonic stem cell derived cell therapy means that the starting material is a human embryonic stem cell line.
And so that's what you're using to in this instance, where you said before, sometimes use a virus to change.
So that's gene therapy.
That's gene therapy. So this specifically.
Right, would be a cell therapy.
So what would be like the simplest way? Like, this is what I'm imagining is like, oh, this person's losing their eyesight. It's like, well, go get some sight stem cells from an embryo.
Right.
And then we just put it in that guy's eyes.
Right.
And now he can see.
So, but, yeah, you're like halfway a few more there. You're halfway there.
I get this science thing. All right, shut it down. I figured it out.
Over. So human embryonic stem cells are pluripotent, which means they can be derived through human intervention into any different cell type that the body makes naturally, okay?
Okay, that's why as an embryo, we could eventually grow organs, skin, bones. Everything comes from embryonic cells.
Exactly.
So, it's like at that point, it's X. Like
right.
The cell is like, we don't know what we're going to be yet.
Right. So I think the important thing to remember about human embryonic stem cells is that they are taken from these embryos are taken usually from an IVF clinic, okay, an in vitro fertilization clinic that helps women and families end up having children, right?
Yeah. So, I'm in my mid-30s. I'm familiar with these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. More and more every day, right?
A lot more friends are talking about that than
absolutely
anything else.
So IVF, kind of the standard at IVF is you make a lot of embryos and then you implant a portion of those. So the rest of them are tossed. And that is standard best, practice. That's what happens. So instead of them getting tossed into the trash, some of those are taken and then they make what is called a stem cell line from them, which means that they can be grown and scaled for use in something like a cell therapy product.
Oh, wow. That is really cool. Like that feels like, again, not to keep harkening back to comic books, but it feels like stem cells are like a magic thing to find. Like,
I think
it's
a lot of people.
Like adamantium or something.
Yeah. I think they have a lot of potential, right? And we're really at the beginning of what that potential is for this kind of regenerative medicine field.
Let's get more into that stuff in a second. Let's back it up a little bit. So were you always into science? Because that's kind of the premise of this podcast is like, I was always into science, but then I was just like, oh, it's easier to take film classes.
Yeah.
So I just backed off.
I was always into science. I've always been interested in science. I did my undergrad at a California State University in Northern California at Humboldt State, which has other, you know,
that name sounds familiar for some. Humboldt comes to my mind for some reason. I couldn't imagine.
Different reasons, probably. Okay. But they have a great science program and biological sciences program there. So I was lucky enough to get my degree from there and work with a California initiative called CIRM, which is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine.
Oh, wow. So you started kind of dabbling in this field already on undergrad.
Right. Very, very young. And they help. One of the main things that CIRM does is they help kind of in get more regenerative medicine research in the state of California. And it was set up during the Bush administration when stem cell research was really cut off. They had really limited it.
I feel like if you don't know exactly what stem cell research is, the thing you know about it is that it's controversial.
Right.
And it's, for some reason, now partisan.
Right,
Or something like, or was partisan.
I think CIRM actually has been a big part of changing that. But what it did is it allowed us to do stem cell research in California where a lot of the rest of the country was unable to kind of move in that direction.
Another reason why California rules. I'm new to out here. I've only been out here for a few years. I'm from New York,
Which
is also sort of like a bastion of like, we do what we want there.
Right.
But man, this last couple of months really makes you feel like California is an oasis. Like it feels like we're in the United State of California.
I totally agree.
So is the controversy around stem cells sort of just like this whole argument about when life is started? Is that... Or is it like goes against God's way to fix someone who has gone blind?
Yeah, I think obviously as a supporter of human embryonic stem cell therapy and research that I'm biased. But I think it's a lot of misunderstanding of where it comes from, right? So I think if there was a better understanding that these are coming from IVF clinics, which basically... there is not a lot of disfavor for in vitro fertilization.
Right. Everyone gets to their own little like pick and choose their battles when it comes to like reproductive rights. It's always like, well, IVF. It's like, well, if you have a problem with this, I could see like, but everyone and all, once it lands on them, I'll say everyone's against stem cell research until they lose their eyesight.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyone who might be against it, it's like, wait a minute, you saying I could? It's like, but it comes from an embryo. No, life begins at, no, fuck it, dude.
Yeah.
You're blind.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I think a lot of it is actually misunderstanding more than anything else.
Right. I would feel like the thing you would hear some politician with keeping party lines out of this, some politician you would hear would be like, they're scraping women's vaginas and giving guys old men eyesight.
Right.
It's like,
that is exactly.
Hardly
and that's
how
why
it works.
Whenever I talk to somebody about it, I really like to start at the beginning, which is this is where they come from. And they come from IVF clinics. And so to give that instead of allowing your imagination to go wild with where,
right,
you know, these how other devious that places that they could be.
Yeah, it's almost like you're, for lack of a better term, using the whole buffalo. It's like, these were going, that's a terrible way to, hold on, touchy territory
human
here.
Embryonic.
Yeah, right, sorry. I need buffalo embryo. I need the eyesight of a buffalo, the worst superhero. I have the eyesight of a buffalo. Is that good or bad? It's like, it's sort of medium. Predators get me all the time. So when you were in undergrad, you were like, because that's what I'm always curious about. Like when you are studying science, to me, at least when I was younger, it was like you either become a science teacher or you become a scientist. But that's like the vaguest term, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I think... I started doing research because we had to, right? To graduate, you had to do kind of a senior research program or project. And I found this really cool associate professor at HSU. It was a woman and she wanted to, you know, she needed more people to do work with. So I started doing research with her and it's more molecular based research, which is not with the cells.
This is where we're a couple of stages bigger.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
It's actually smaller.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I knew that.
And,
edit this out. I'm a genius. Or leave that in. Oh God, I shouldn't have such a contentious relationship with my editor. So we were saying that molecules are actually smaller than cells.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
Golgi bodies, ribosomes.
Oh, there you go. So you're impressing me.
I was a biology major for 2 weeks in college.
Two.
I declared before I went, and then 2 weeks and in, changed. I was like, I am not doing science. School, you can actually pick whatever you want to do here, and you don't have to work hard at all. My lack of drive really ended up, you know, hamstringing me.
Yeah. Well, I took a few years off in the middle of my undergrad. And so when I went back, I wanted to be
you
there, right?
More of an adult. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like you should have shouldn't start college till you're 21.
I agree.
I feel like you should have to go to work somewhere or study something specifically. Cause it's like, no one knows what I wish I had just had two more years of life experience someone was like, what do you want to do for the rest of your life?
Do you remember when, Malia Obama came out and was like, I'm taking a gap year before I go to college. That freaked me out. I was like, that's brilliant. I wish I could have done that too.
I know. The second I heard about it.
I did end up, but it was a gap in the middle.
That's an interesting gap then too,
because
you have I'm maybe not ready for, mm-hmm. That happens. My brother of mine went to six colleges before he really got any traction as to what he wanted to do in life. And now he's very successful and doing great. But when you're 18, who
you
knows?
You don't know yourself.
Yeah. Yeah,
let alone what you're going to do.
And I think that's some of the thing with for me, a lot of people say we're a spoiled generation. So that's why no one's going into STEM or whatever like that. And it's everyone wants to be liberal arts. I think it's also because you're asking 17-year-old kids.
Right.
If you're asking a 17-year-old kid what they want to be, they're a ballerina or a movie director. Everyone wants to just be a celebrity of some sort. But if you're 21 and maybe you lived life, you're actually, I really problem solving. you might, but when you're 17, it's I don't want to be a fucking scientist. That sounds like homework.
Yeah. And, you know, what ended up happening was I found research and I found cell culture during that time. These were just classes I had to take. And so this opportunity that CIRM presented me and presented, you know, through a grant that HSU had gotten, led me to UCSF. So it kind of brought me down to the Bay Area where I was paid, not a lot, but paid to do research at one of the major research universities on the West Coast.
Oh, wow.
So
this is the University of California, San Francisco?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's a big research school. I don't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you went there for post-grad work?
It was a post-bac, a post-baccalaureate.
Oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
So there, I got to really dig in, and I thought about going back, you know, staying in school and getting my master's or my PhD, but I also wanted to make money.
Yeah, so that sounds reasonable. I feel like that's a common thought process amongst humans.
Mm-hmm. So I decided to look into going into industry early, which...
I wanted to make money, so I decided to become a scientist.
Exactly. So
classic.
Yeah, yeah. So I started looking for a job, and that's how I ended up down in San Diego in the biotech down here.
Oh, that's awesome. So mm-hmm. that's really cool. Now, my question for you is, when you're an undergrad in science, is it like any other college experience, or is it if you guys are all doing research and stuff, or is it still Fridays and Saturdays are still we're partying, or starting Thursdays as it was in most schools? We were Tuesdays, Thursdays, Friday, and Saturday. It was 4 nights a week we were partying.
I don't know if going to HSU is comparable to a lot of other universities.
Okay, that makes sense.
You know, I think because we're so small, it's 7,500 people, and there's not a Greek group, so there's no fraternities or sororities, but... my experience there was, we had normal weekends.
Right.
We hung out. We had house parties and stuff like that.
People are choosing HSU for a reason, and it's not necessarily for partying.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think my experience was I found a really good group of really smart people that were also fun and funny to hang out with. So a lot of the studying that we had to do was still enjoyable because we may have been, you know, in the lab or, at the library until 10 p.m. studying, making flashcards, working through things. But
it's a good group of people.
Yeah,
going
It was a small, really, really smart group of people, and it made it fun. So it's still, you know, some of the best years of my life for sure.
Oh yeah, that's awesome to hear.
Yeah.
So then after your post-bac work, you were at UCSF,
right?
And how long were you there? What were you doing there a little more specifically?
So
your eyes just lit up in
a
way.
I'm gonna have to figure out. This is some of the hardest things for me to explain.
Oh, that's fine. Because then let me try to help. Because okay. That's part of the show.
Good.
Is
we'll
me
be a team.
Figuring out a way to get it dumbed down so I can understand it.
Okay.
And then maybe these idiots that listen to this garbage can enjoy it. I'm just kidding.
Wait, I'm going to listen to this.
Okay.
Though.
Yeah. Well, case in point.
So when I was at UCSF, I was in the Costello Lab, which is they focus on glioblastoma, which is brain cancer.
Okay, here's a weird moment to say this. That's what my father died from.
Oh, wow.
Holy shit, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Connection.
Oh, wow. Small world.
So, yeah.
God, for anyone who listens to my podcast, know that having a dead dad is a huge part of my personality. Now I got to force it into my science podcast.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that.
Oh, that's okay. It's been a while. I should stop talking about it. but that's really funny.
Yeah. So I was part of it's the Costello Lab is part of the Brain Tumor Research Group. So they focus on glioblastoma, but they also focus on this one way in which genes and so our cells are controlled, which is called epigenetics.
Ooh, I like this. Okay.
Okay.
Let's get into
this. So epi means like on top, right?
Right, like epidermis.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So epigenetics is different molecules and compounds that actually bind to the DNA strands and therefore control what genes are expressed, but not at the DNA level by binding and modifying what can be expressed and therefore...
What I'm cells? Like trying to. I'm like holding my breath. I'm like, I think I. Oh my.
And therefore, what cells make and how they act.
Okay, so let me see if I got what epigenetics is. Right? Is that what it?
Yeah.
Even, okay. I already worried that I said it wrong. So it is like, oh, here is DNA.
Right.
Whatever the double helix, Gattaca, and we can just attach something to it.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it in this case?
So let's start with, there's a lot of examples, but let's focus on one, which is methylation. So DNA methylation,
okay,
which is just a carbon with three hydrogen atoms and they bind on top of the DNA.
Okay. So that just a carbon, so that would be CH3?
Yes.
CH3?
A methyl group.
A methyl group.
Yeah.
I've been to a few methyl groups. It's a completely different where I come from. It's usually just a barren mattress in the middle of an abandoned building. It's like a book group, but for knocking your teeth out.
I'm learning
out the
so much about you.
I have varied hobbies. I sort of, you know, I go amongst different crowds.
Right.
So you take a methyl group.
Right.
Put it on top of a DNA.
Yeah.
And then now the DNA shows something different.
Right.
Or eventually on a cellular level will make something change. Like, so what is like an example of a small change? Like,
so like a methyl group would either cause a gene not to be expressed or to be expressed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So someone has a gene for some sort of condition, whatever it is. Like, we'll just say red hair to make it simple. It's
right.
Like you can go in, add a methyl group and shut off the red hair gene or turn it on and maybe
right.
express that in DNA.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a good way of thinking about it.
Okay. That is the most perfect like businessy answer. That's a good way of thinking about it. It's like a way of saying like,
I've been
you don't get it, but
while.
You're speaking.
Yeah.
You don't get it, but we don't have time to get it. So we used methyl group as an example. What would be something that a genetic trait that you could turn on or off?
So like? in the Costello lab, what we were looking at is that there is a gene, okay, mm-hmm. and its methylation pattern, if it is methylated in you or in me, or if it is not, would be a way to predict if the chemotherapeutic agent, which is the standard of care, for glioblastoma patients would work or not.
Oh, you can find that out. If it's a certain, you can find out if it's a certain type of glioblastoma.
You can tell if the standard of care, the chemo that patient is going to get will work or not based on the methylation pattern of a gene in their body.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So that helps people find out the easier way that the chemo wouldn't work rather than going through several rounds.
Yeah,
of it.
It's not used predictively, at least when I was still doing research
Okay.
I don't think it's used predictively. It had been found that there was a correlation. So we were kind of building a data set around that correlation.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. So it's more about finding out that you can do that means a certain thing. And that's what else can we find out?
Yeah.
What else can we find out?
And that's basic research, right? So basic research, you have to start at the beginning. And so you take these, you answer small questions, and then you build on those to hopefully be able to build a therapeutic or translational product.
I have to say that that's my favorite thing about science, and specifically scientists and people who are science-minded or math-minded. I find when it comes to problem solving, I love the idea of like, all right, let's just back it all. Look, we don't need to cure brain cancer today.
Right.
What we need to find out is what happens if we methylate a certain, you know, like,
right.
And now we have that. We have to work hard and dig and find out that now we have that info. We're 1% done. Like, it reminds me of like a video game where it's like, well, clean out the whole first level. Make sure you get all the hidden.
Baby steps.
Get all the hidden treasure and shit like that. Now you're ready for level two. And then
Absolutely.
When we get to the final level, you're going to be 100% complete.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a lot of it. I think you have to take the baby steps to get to the end. But also what I've learned in cell therapy specifically is that if you're not looking at your end goal, the baby steps are not going to add up to success either.
Right. Yeah.
And that's something we're still learning as an industry and overall.
Is that because you're not sure what the end goal can be with this new frontier science? Like,
I think that it depends. In industry, you usually have a company that's based around specific focus, right? Specific, like, hey, we want to cure this or we want to cure that. But if you don't think about how to get that all the way to the end and what that development cycle is going to look like, what you're going to end up having are a lot of stumbling blocks on your way.
Right.
So you have to kind of come at it from both ends.
Start the book at the beginning and the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, the beginning and the end and finish in the middle.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Big picture, what's on the horizon for this field? Like, what's potential? What's possible?
One of the golden examples is the first human embryonic stem cell-derived cell therapy to ever go to the FDA to be cleared for clinical trials is called OPC1.
Okay.
Basically, what it does is it's for spinal cord injury. So the pie in the sky is happening, right? The pie in the sky is that this product could potentially cause people that are quadriplegics or paraplegics to be able to regain movement. And some of their patients now that are in their trial are starting to do that.
Holy shit. That's
so, I mean, that's pie in the sky, right? That's Christopher Reeves. That was his big dream, right? And it is happening.
I mean, we're talking not to keep bringing back, I'm supposed to keep it secular in my mind, but you're talking about a miracle. Right.
Sounds like that.
Yeah.
Right?
You're talking about like if someone got someone to get out of a wheelchair and walk in a fucking tent in the heartland, everyone would call that person a prophet.
Right.
But a group of science minded people who are, you know, using embryonic stem cells.
Yeah.
That's wild to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the beginning. Like, you know, who knows? Like, I'm sure you're familiar with the anecdote about horse manure in Manhattan.
Right.
Like, they got all the greatest science minds together to try to figure out what they could do about all these horses and all the shitting they were doing on the island of Manhattan, and they could not come up with a solution. All the brightest minds in the world could not come up with a solution. And guess what? That problem was solved by the invention of the automobile.
Huh.
Like, no one saw cars coming, but it's like the greatest minds in the world. Like, what are we doing about all this horse shit? And then all of a sudden, it's like, it's not even an issue because we have cars. Yeah, and also, like, it's one of those things, too, where it's like, God knows where we're going to be down the line, like what small advancement methylating, you learn methylating that just extrapolates out, that's butterfly effect
absolutely.
To something down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's OPC1 is kind of what everyone looks at as really being furthering the field, because now for the first time we're seeing efficacy for a human embryonic stem cell derived cell therapy.
Right, that goes with that. Like, I mean, you don't even think of that. You think of just purely of like, oh, cool, this person can walk again. But what that means also is that people who want to make money, so those are the people you need to invest money, see that shit works.
Absolutely.
And it's like, holy crap, that works. And then maybe the people who are dragging their feet for whatever reasons about whatever bullshit reasons they have against stem cells.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute. You know, like that's a way to put it right on someone's front door. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I know you're wishy-washy about it, but we're making people fucking walk.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Is it foreseeable that it's like Yeah, we could repair cartilage. We could create bones where there were breaks. We could, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Use potentially in like a sort of, now I'm just going pie in the sky,
yeah.
Like organic prosthetics. Like, is there like a foreseeable way to like regrow an arm for an amputee?
Absolutely. And you don't necessarily, for all of those, basically every function that you're talking about, there are companies working on those, and they're not necessarily all human embryonic stem cell based.
Okay.
So there's other ways to get from A to B. And those can be using, you know, your own cells to make, you know, new bone or new blood or whatever you need. And also using donor cells to then produce things that you need, like a piece of tissue.
Oh, interesting. Like getting some portion of someone else or some portion of yourself from a different area and to create some
Yeah. So it's a really big field. My expertise is in human embryonic stem cells.
Okay.
And those cell therapies, but it's a lot larger than that. And there's a lot of ways to look at the applications of them. And we're just, like you said, we're really at the beginning. And putting those building blocks in place and having companies like a Geron or like a company I used to work for that is called Viacyte, having those companies take the first steps, we're all learning from those. And as a community, we're growing.
And that's another thing I like about science too, is like someone's over here working on methylating, someone's over here working on something. It's like, hey, I'm seeing that this is on a obviously much larger scale, but it's like, hey guys, I'm seeing methylating does this. It's like, oh, that's funny, 'cause I'm seeing this happens over here. It's like, oh, hey, with each other's information, we're going even further. That's what I like about science. Like, mm-hmm. The pursuit of knowledge is, granted, everyone wants to make money, mm-hmm. as we've learned, you know, fuck grad school, you mm-hmm. know, make paper.
That's my new motto.
Yeah, fuck grad school, get money.
No.
That's the a classic science motto.
Oh, no.
Make them paper stacks, son. but the pursuit of knowledge is there. That's the fundamentals of science, which makes it so exciting, is whereas people aren't like, you know, hoarding. I mean, I'm sure there are people who are hoarding information, but that is just that's unscientific of them.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of debate depending on who, you know, where you work or if you're in academia, when you publish and when you don't, and hiding your information to make sure you get as much out of it as possible.
Right.
But overall, I mean, that's the whole point. We have scientific journals that are peer reviewed, right? Hey, here's all my research. Now I'm going to have it checked by other people, and they can say, oh, we don't think that you did this study. You need to do that, or ask questions, and then publish it and allow the rest of the world, you know, the fruits of that labor, which is cool.
It's so awesome. It's literally like knocking, like doing almost nearly infinite to-do list. And science is just at the beginning going like, well, I checked these three things. That means this fifth thing could, you know, we could check four and five now because we know these three. And
right.
It's just slowly, eventually, until we've mapped out how everything works.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's so fun. Like, and it's infinite. Like if, you know, you're on the smallest level. And then when you talk to like on last season, I talked to someone who works at JPL, and they're like solving stuff that's like as far away from us as we could imagine.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is going to make me sound like the cliche stoner that I am, but it's just so crazy to imagine that there's people who are working on like microscopic levels inside of us, and then other people are working on whatever the telescopic things way far outside of us. And we're eventually going to meet in the middle. Like, we're going to be solving everything. Every scientist is going to eventually, with their paintbrushes, all land at one spot. It's like, all right, well, we cleared
we
it up.
It.
This is how everything works. We've reached singularity. We all beam up and become one big, like, mass piece of energy.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Sorry. I think I had I wanted to have a cough drop. I think I ate an edible Jolly Rancher. I'm tripping balls.
You're making me feel like what I do is way cooler than I feel on a normal day.
So this idea of, like, embryonic stem cells can become anything is sort of like what, if that's organic, if that's biology to the body, there's people who are doing that with 3D printing where you can make almost anything that besides obviously, organic tissue, or can you tune in next week?
So So yeah, I think part of this regenerative medicine space and biotech in general is also something that I have some experience in, which is 3D bioprinting.
Oh, this that phrase alone is yeah, I could write a screenplay based on 3D bioprinting.
Yeah. So it just like any other 3D printer, you know, that's out there that makes molds or whatever. There's 3D bioprinters. And what these printers do is they do 3D deposition of human cells.
Jesus.
That make pieces of human tissue.
That's really crazy. 'Cause like I have a normal printer that just prints computer paper.
Right.
And that thing is a huge pain in the ass to use. It's like an absolute hassle.
Yeah.
And it's always breaking and I need toner and this is plugged. And yes. Now there's we expect like this thing that prints people.
We're not printing people yet.
Printer.
No.
The
people.
Human tissue printer.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just a 3D, or not just, but it's a 3D.
Just a 3D thing where you make organic matter?
Yeah. So it does controlled deposition of human cells.
Oh, wow.
And then those cells mature into small pieces of human tissue.
Wow. What does the 3D printer itself look like when it's like, is it like all on a cellular level to begin with? Like, or is it like there is a, because in my head, there's like a mold that's shaped like a lung that like a small robotic arm is just like squirting juice into, and that it would eventually become a lung.
So, you know, the idea of 3D bioprinting is a little bit of debate, like what do we call 3D bioprinting and what do we not?
Yeah.
So, you know, you've seen like the mouse with the ear on the back of it.
That's like the most I almost mentioned it before, but I left it out. I was like, don't be the guy that's like, the thing I know about stem cells is you put ears on mice.
But, it depends who you ask what you consider 3D bioprinting or not. Do you need a scaffold or can you have a scaffold and kind of what you're saying, kind of squirt cells into that and then have that, is that 3D bioprinting? The most kind of pure definition of 3D bioprinting, that would not be considered 3D bioprinting.
Right, right.
You would have to have, like I said, controlled deposition of human cells. Oh. And so 3D...
Controlled deposition of human cells mean place a blank cell here, this kind of cell here, like literally on a cellular level.
Like a cell paste. Think about like a cell paste. Uh-huh. That's a very common term.
Oh, wow.
Like so a paste of cells.
And then you activate it to become what you need it to become. Like say you're making a liver.
Okay.
So you just turn cell paste, like you turn on the no, okay. I love it. You're like, no. Yeah, please.
No.
I have work to do. Let me just talk. Fair enough.
You use what you do is you use human primary cells, or what I have the most experience doing, is using human primary cells that already have specific identity. So different kinds of cells that are required to make or are found in, let's say, liver.
Yeah.
And then depositing those cells, and then they will kind of self-organize into what a native human tissue looks like.
Wow. I guess you just put enough cells to make a liver together. They're like, hey, all right, let's just fucking be a liver, guys. You know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. They do. Hey, they talk to each other.
Yeah. Hey, you're. Oh, let's connect. I'm usually in a liver cell, but you know, now I'm cell based. So I'm cell based now. Hey, look, I recognize you.
Exactly.
Oh, that's wow. I could use one of those livers. Yeah. Do you have a 3D bioprinter here? Should we start it now? Because I feel like it might take a while.
Yeah.
Hold on. I just got to remember my Wi-Fi password. Hold on.
Let me get online.
My Bluetooth 3D bioprinter.
Yeah.
Print from your phone.
Maybe eventually. You never know.
I always like imagine like the future of, because 3D printing is one of those things, and stem cell, that's what excites me and why I wanted to talk to you about stem cell. Stem cell feels like the same thing where it's like the end result, we might not even know. It's like, oh yeah, you can live your life 40 times over. It's like when you're starting to get old, you're like, all right, get out the cell juice and cell paste and create a Gabra-sized mold and just like 310 pounds, 295, let's say. By the time this comes out, maybe I'll have lost some weight. New Year's, new me. Like 300 pounds of cell paste in a mold, cook it, you know, hit defrost 9999, start.
How do you know this process so well already?
I know, man. I'm telling you, man. I've seen the future.
Yeah, that's all the IP. You're just spilling it.
Is that like something that is in the realm of possibility? Like
printing a new Gabrus?
Yeah, printing a new Sarah to be like, well, I'm getting to be I'm getting to be the ripe old age of 40, so I might as well cut my head off and build a new one. No, I'm being hyperbolic here, but is there something like we can just sort of like create ourselves again?
Yeah, I think we're at the very beginnings of all of this, right? So yeah. I think with 3D bioprinting, our next big hurdle in that field, what is going to happen is when you scale an organ out, how do you print a whole organ? Right now,
yeah,
we're not bioprinting full size livers.
Yeah. Okay? It's not like people are lined up for transplants. You guys are like, oh, hot off the press, put right. it in, so, move on.
And the reason you can't do that is because we're not sweet potatoes. Like, we're not the same all right. the way through, right?
Oh, I always wanted to be a sweet potato. You are a sweet potato, Sarah.
It's so sweet of you.
That's me.
But there's, like, for example, with the liver, it's not just the same all the way through. So when you want to make a full-size organ, there's a very complex architecture inside the organ that needs to be there for it to be functional. So how do you make that complex architecture? How do you get bigger blood veins running, you know, into the liver, the hepatic portal vein?
Right.
How do you make that happen? And that's a big question. And I think that's going to be the next big step that bioprinting has to take before we're talking about printing new Sarahs when I'm 95.
Did you leave this running while I was at work? There's, yeah. 40, there's 40 Sarahs running around the house. The house looks great.
Very clean.
Just 40 Sarahs on their day off getting things done. That's like, all right,
that's a dream. Yeah. That's a dream.
So normally the reason anyone does a podcast, coming from a point of view of a comedian, is to plug something that they have going on, like a book but I find with doing the layman, scientists are often like, no, as a matter of fact, this podcast was a waste of my life. I have things I could be doing, like stem cell research right now, instead of talking to some fucking goober about printing humans.
No, I mean, I don't really have anything to plug other than Dark Horse Consulting.
Right.
And if anyone out there is looking for kind of the help that I think we, as some of the best subject matter experts in cell and gene therapy process and product engineering, can provide, then they're always welcome to seek us out. But I mean, really, I think I'm very thankful because you're here reminding me that actually what I do is cool. And, yeah. And like I said, it's easy to lose sight of
it
that.
It is very cool. And I'm not just saying that I need a reason to have a podcast. I do this podcast is an incessant misuse of my time, but I love to do it so much that I was so happy to drive down to San Diego to talk to you about this.
Oh, thank you.
Oh yeah. No. Thank you. The thank is for sure on you. What, maybe we could leave this with, if anyone is listening to this and for some reason still in 2017 is sort of iffy about stem cell research, what would you like to tell them? I mean, obviously, we're getting it from IVF. Is that the word I'm looking for? I keep thinking of America's Funniest Videos. I want to say AVFV. That is... I'm a child. Is there anyone who, just in case someone is still listening and we can use this soapbox for good here, anyone who's still opposed to stem cell research, what would you tell them, you know, at this point? Like, is there, what piece of information would you give them to be like, if you an in-law at a party or like an uncle at Thanksgiving is like, you know what they're doing to these poor embryos? Like, what would you say to someone like that?
I think that the providence of these human embryonic stem cells and what they can provide for our world really has unparalleled potential, right?
Right.
And I would ask them to do a little research to really learn, like you said, where these come from and what the other fate of these embryos would be if they were not utilized by different companies or research groups
yeah.
for the good they are. And I think that's kind of the most important part. And when you have successes, which are coming through now on these human embryonic stem cell derived cell therapies, I think that also will speak for itself.
Right. There's stuff you could point at now and it's like, and we're just getting cracking. You have
we're
no
just
idea.
Getting started.
Yeah. You have no idea where we could end up. So yep. yeah, I feel like that's a great answer to almost anyone who has a problem is like, look at what your issue is with it.
Yeah.
Do a little research and see if you're fighting the right fight here.
Yeah. A lot of times I think that's it. It's just misinformation.
Yeah. It's just, you know, hearing a buzzword, fake news, huh? 2017, the year of fake news. Oh, God. Sorry. Bring it on down.
Yeah, bring it.
It's funny. You know the sad state of politics. If you bring up your deceased father and you don't get as sad as when you say the phrase fake news. When you say fake news, I was like, oh, not this shit again.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah Mills, thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, this has been a real blast.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
I might have some follow-up questions for my own, because if you can do a 3D bioprinting, you can help me set up my Epson. Thank you, Sarah, for taking the time out of your busy day to talk to me about that. Guys, we are on the cusp of something huge here. We're talking printing people that will fight for our entertainment. Okay, I'm actually being told that is not true and not what they're going for at all. Fair enough. Listen to next week's episode where I talk to Anthony DiBenedetti, a man who is melding the worlds of both science and business. And based on his name, he just might be German. The Layman is a Stitcher original and a production of Midroll Media. My EPs are Chris Bannon and Jenny Radlett. My producer is the wonderful Rob Pera, and I am your layman, John Gabris.